One of the goals of this podcast is to make it easier for you to use event streaming technologies, which brings up a question. Why is it so hard? To attempt to answer this, I got to talk to Michael Dragalis. He's product manager for stream processing at Confluent and a developer of no small acclaim himself. We talked about stream processing, distributed systems, and more on today's episode of Streaming Audio, a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud. Welcome back, everyone, to Streaming Audio. It's my pleasure today to have my friend and coworker in the virtual studio, Michael Dragalis. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
You got it. Hey, tell us a little bit about you. You happen to be a coworker of mine at Confluent. What do you do here? What did you do before? Tell us about Michael.
Yeah, happy to. So I am a product manager here at Confluent, and I work on our stream processing products, which includes Kafka Streams and KSQL. So my background is that I'm actually an engineer by trade. I spent about 8 years building distributed systems products for a variety of companies, including my own. I worked on stream processing on a framework called Onyx, which is pretty popular in the Clojure programming language. And so I founded a company on top of that and built some more distributed systems infrastructure as a product. And at one point in the middle of the company, we had mutually decided with Confluent that we would be a pretty good fit together. And so I brought my team into Confluent around August of last year and have transitioned since into a product management role, which has been a great fit. It has been quite fun working here on these kinds of things.
Yeah, and it's been great for me to get to know you and work together. What product or products do you manage?
So I manage Kafka Streams and KSQL. Kafka Streams being a JVM library for doing stream processing primarily in Java, with sort of a code-oriented view of processing all your data, as well as KSQL, which is a streaming SQL engine for Apache Kafka that essentially allows you to use a SQL dialect to process your data in a higher-level language.
Cool. In your introduction, when you were talking about your work here and you're coming here, you said you were product manager. In the sequence of things that you revealed, you deprived me of a joke I was thinking of making, which was, you're a product manager, so I guess that means you can't write code. The timing didn't happen, but, I do want to talk about that. Number one, if you know any PMs, sometimes that's the case. Often it's not the case that, you know, you do come into that role from an engineering background, but, you have a very recent and, I don't know, the word hardcore is a little overused, but, I'll just say an interesting engineering background, right? I mean, you have built some things.
Yeah, thanks.
And on those things, they seem to have revolved around stream processing. I mean, is that just in recent years, or when did that start? When did that interest strike you?
That's actually been a theme for me out of college. So in my last year, I went to the Rochester Institute of Technology. I thankfully had a little bit of time to do an independent study with a professor that I was pretty close with. And he encouraged me to check out Erlang and to learn a bit about distributed systems. And so I spent a part of that year really diving into what this whole area is all about. And ever since he kind of put me in touch with that world, I just felt like it was something I really wanted to work on in great depth. So when I had left college, I mentioned that I started this project called Onyx. That's kind of most akin to Kafka Streams. And I spent the better part of 4 years working on that with Lucas Bradstreet, who later became my business co-founder. And so that was really like an intellectual journey for me to really understand all the challenges of making distributed systems work really well and really reliably, and then also to build them in the products that people like. And soon after that, kind of the product that the company that I co-founded built that was of interest to was essentially a streaming data warehouse for Kafka. And so it sort of allowed you to stream all your data in through Kafka, create an efficient index structure in object stores like Amazon S3, and then read them back into Kafka seamlessly. And so you sort of get the streaming native aspect of a data warehouse that you'd otherwise just, think of as just a blob of data sitting in S3. And so these are the kinds of things that I've really enjoyed working on over the years, and this is kind of why this continues to be a great role for me at Confluent.
Yeah, it's passion. So I'll start just a really simple question. Why are distributed systems hard? And I realize that's a complex question in the sense that it assumes that they are, but I think we can grant that. And why?
Yeah, I think the two things that are really difficult are partial failure and asynchrony. So the idea with distributed systems is that you need many independent processes to collaborate to do a thing well and to get it done. But the problem is that it's not an all or nothing concept. You can have some of your processes succeed and some of your processes fail. And that introduces you into these really strange error states that you wouldn't otherwise think of in a fully sequential program. And so that's one half of it. And then the other half is asynchrony. Likewise, when you're in a single-threaded sequential program, you do steps A, B, and C, and you can really easily reason about what's happening based on each line that's executing over time. But with distributed systems, you know, it's not even only that you have different threads doing different things with shared memory. You just have completely independent machines operating at different points in time. And so you actually can't rely on, you know, say, a shared wall clock to do things in a correct way. You have to use much more advanced concepts to sort of build the right thing. And so both of these together make distributed systems a really, really difficult thing to do well.
Right. There is no shared wall clock. In principle, you can't. And I think asynchrony is a part of the formal definition of what makes a distributed system is that there are computers that don't share a clock. So, you know, that's by definition what one is, and also in practice, what tends to make them difficult, because you don't know what now is.
That's right.
Yeah. And, you know, by definition, you have to be using multiple computers. Otherwise, it would be a simpler, better life if you just wrote one dang piece of Python that owned the file system and lived that week. Go home early from work. It would be great.
And I actually do think that that's probably, like, if I can give any bit of advice during this podcast, it's that if you can do it with a single machine that's pretty beefy, you probably should do that. Yep. As it turns out, hardware is scaling pretty well, and you can process some data sets that, you know, look like they could be monsters in terms of tens of gigs. You're probably fine with a single machine, and you'll save yourself a lot of energy.
Yeah, yeah. 10 years ago, they were Hadoop workloads, and now they are not Hadoop. They're not, you know, the modern equivalent. They're something that you can get done on one big instance. And I tell that to people all the time. Every time I talk to an audience that is, you know, about something to do with distributed systems, I'll say, if you cannot, don't.
Right.
it's just better.
And what's really interesting about that is that that's great advice for batch data sets where you might just have like a file with a lot of data in it or several files with a lot of data in it. But as soon as you go into real-time streaming, you can keep things in, you know, single-threaded and sort of more localized, but you still do need to switch into this different model where you don't know how much data you're going to receive and what order it's going to come in. And so no matter what, as soon as you decide to play the real-time game, you actually have to take on a number of challenges, which you can't rescind or retract.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's kind of the joke that I'm making there, is that the reality is most of the interesting systems that we're building these days are distributed systems, whether we want them to be or not. And there are some batch analysis jobs that aren't anymore, and maybe were in the past, and just due to growth and hardware speeds, you know, we luck out. But that is really only addressing that problem in the margins. And for most of us who are building systems that do interesting things and solve interesting problems, they are distributed. So you mentioned streaming data. First of all, what is your favorite term? You said real time. You said streaming. I mean, you and I generally say streaming. You're the PM of stream processing.
So doesn't matter to me as long as you're doing it, because it means you're probably building something kind of interesting. Exactly. I think streaming data is probably a good canonical term.
Yeah. So what is it? Give us your definition of you know, what makes a data set or a problem a streaming problem versus not.
Yeah, I think the key attributes are that it is unbounded. You don't know how big the data set will be, and it will continuously arrive or continuously be given to you. So it's sort of a matter of size. And then order. The data might not all show up in the same order. So if you think about how this works, you might have some phones that are transmitting data to a central server, and that's you know, you, generally as soon as the data is generated on the phone, it's sent out to those central servers. But if someone goes into the jungle and they no longer have an internet connection or a network connection, they actually can't send that data for like a couple days till they get out of the jungle. And so now you have to deal with this strange concept of out of order data. And so for me, those are the two things that I think of when I think of streaming data.
Unbounded and potentially out of order.
That's right.
Right. That makes sense. So why is that hard? I mean, that's the question almost answers itself, but you've built enough of these systems that I suspect you could go into some interesting stories of really exactly what is challenging about that.
I think it comes down to this like idea of unknown unknowns. If you don't know your total data set, you actually can't reason globally about it. If you knew what the total data set would be, you can decide some interesting characteristics about it and maybe perform some optimizations knowing the totality of everything that you have on your hands. But if you don't know how much of it you're going to get or when you're going to get it, you need to deal with things like bursty data. You know, all of a sudden you may receive several gigs of data really quickly and then followed by like nothing. And so the resources that you need to handle that are really different as opposed to if you just had a fixed piece of data, you would allocate the right number of machines to process it with, and that would be really simple. And then the other thing about ordering that's kind of funny is that most programming languages and frameworks for working with data kind of assume that you have the full scope of data within view. And so if it's not the way that you want it, you can simply reorder it. But with streaming, that's not so. You really don't know when you're going to get all the data that's pertinent to whatever you're doing. And so you could maybe be tried to buffer some of it up and reorder it, but that has lots of problems because how much memory will you use? And so that's not really recommended. And how do you sort of do these look behinds where you've gotten some data early or late, and then you need to associate it with data elsewhere. And so these abstractions and concepts are really still being figured out both in industry and academia. And we're getting closer with, ideas of windows, which are not so new, but are being used a lot now. And various models around how you emit data downstream and how you join it up with different points in time. But this is really early stuff, and it's certainly not all figured out.
Yeah, there is a sense, honestly, that's one of the cool things about your career is that it has focused exclusively on this field even before this was a thing a lot of people talked about. 5-10 years ago, streaming was kind of restricted to a few very large scale or very special purpose kinds of applications, and it is by no means mainstream right now. I mean, most developers I talk to are still scratching their heads and trying to figure out this new paradigm. But you were kind of there. Why is it on the rise? I'm making these big assumptions and all these questions, but obviously we agree that streaming is on the rise. I don't have to defend that claim on this show, but why? Yeah, I mean, the people who are doing it, LinkedIn was doing it 10 years ago because LinkedIn is LinkedIn. Most companies aren't. So why does everybody else care?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Thinking back to like 2012 or so, right around when I graduated, there wasn't a lot in the way of open source stream processors. So Storm had just come out, and that was gaining quite a bit of traction as like the way to do stream processing. Spark had just come out with its micro batch technique. But Kafka Streams wasn't around then, and a lot of that's kind of why I set out and I built Onyx, which is its parallel to Kafka Streams, because there wasn't very much then. And now if you look at the number of products that are out there, both commercially and open source for doing stream processing, that's just completely exploded. And it's so interesting to see that over a 6 or an 8 year period happening. I think a lot of the benefits of doing real-time stream processing have been espoused. There certainly are really clear business cases for why you'd want to essentially tighten down a process loop and get answers faster or build apps that sort of respond in real time. I think that's obvious if you could sort of have that choice and it could be as easy as doing it the way that you used to be. And so maybe half of it is sort of a business-facing phenomena where people are starting to recognize that you can have that. And you can have that for less cost. And I also think that engineers are starting to appreciate what it means to process a log of events, either real time or otherwise. You sort of get this magical benefit through Kafka that all your data is set into a topic, and it is immutably there forever, unless, you know, you use compaction or you clip it off the end of the log. It's an immutable fact set. And you have this sort of multi-subscriber model where different consumers can read that data however they like, and they're not going to step on each other's toes. And so that's really interesting from a data storage perspective, but from a processing perspective, it's really interesting because now you can localize all the computation and you can look at the view of your data set as if no one else was looking at it. And so you really blow past these ideas of these challenges of multi-tenancy and what schema the data needs to be and where it can be accessed. It's a replicated commit log. And so you can move it around as you like. You can get your own copy. And that gives you, you know, not to be cliche, it gives you organizational agility. More than one team can work with the data set and can do whatever they like with that. And that's a really powerful idea.
Yeah, it is. And I honestly think that's the most powerful one right there, in my opinion. Needing real-time analysis, you hinted at the sort of business-driven demand for stream processing, that is a faster answer is better. If it was no more expensive to get the answer and the answer is just as accurate, you always want it faster, right? That's just a kind of a pure utility. And so there are some systems that put a lot of value on the timeliness of the computation. And so those push people to streaming, and that's obvious enough. But that's, again, that's a bigger set of the people who are linked in. You don't have to be massive web scale to have fairly hard real-time requirements on your processing, but that still isn't everybody. There are plenty of people who are like, well, no, I mean, I guess real-time ETL would be good, but nobody's you know, hitting me in the back of the head for it. But that collaboration model, you didn't say collaboration, but you know, you said my data is stored as an immutable event log, and I have all of these orthogonal readers of that data that can't step on each other's toes, don't need to coordinate in terms of the computation that they're doing. And so the people in an organization are now free to sort of innovate separately, to work separately, and build their own services around the data. I think that, in my opinion, that's one of the most important drivers we've got here.
I agree. I think we can rapidly get to a time where real-time data is not just applicable for big companies, but it's actually useful for small teams who have small data sets that may be quite sporadic. And there's a lot of architectural challenges to get there. I mean, if you want something to be, you know, roughly real-time, maybe responsive within a couple of seconds, you need infrastructure sitting around to be able to process that. But I feel like that's what's really going to make streaming take off, is when it's as available as maybe Ruby on Rails was for web developers back in the mid-2000s. Whoever can sort of get to that model where it's just universally applicable and everyone can reap those benefits.
That's a tall order. I want to come back to that. Stream processing as Ruby on Rails. I can't decide whether I love that or I don't love that. But that's provocative. So we'll come back to that. Well, what do you think it'll take to get there? The Ruby on Rails level. And maybe I should, in the event that anyone in the audience was not writing code in the mid-2000s, you know, Rails is these days a somewhat less important framework than it was 10 or 12 years ago. But just super easy web, MVC web framework for building monolithic web apps in a very friendly and expressive language, right? And anybody could take a weekend and learn Rails and write an interesting application, because all of the hard parts about connecting to the database and routing web requests and rendering HTML templates and all that stuff was just there. And you just walked in and it happened. So what does that look like in stream processing, and how do we get there? This is a great question to ask a product manager of stream processing for a very important stream processing vendor, by the way.
I spend a fair amount of time thinking about this, and I don't want to give away the farm for what we have planned or what we're thinking.
Of course,
but I remember a quote from DHH when he was introducing Rails. I think the video is actually fairly well known. I'm not sure how you'd find it, but if you looked up the first time he introduced Rails, I'm fairly certain he said something like, "You know, look at what I'm doing here. Look, I'm creating, you know, X, Y, and Z, and this is how I got there. But more importantly, look at what I'm not doing." And he rattled off a long list of things that Rails had completely taken care of.
Right.
And I think it really gets you to that point through a reduction of concepts. You don't just want to layer over them and just, you know, sort of push them down the stack and hide them completely, because, you know, that never seems to work. I feel like ORM was really the epitome of just trying to hide something that was complex, but was a necessary complexity, which was data manipulation. I feel like stream processing has some elements where we can actually build something where you're not thinking about these things all the time. They don't need to be so in your face, and they actually can be taken care of rather universally. So I feel like designing and building a product that can just make you think about fewer things is part of the answer. And then I think part of the answer, which is maybe less, less satisfying, is an education problem, which is teaching people about what it means to write programs that process data that is bursty or asynchronous or arriving out of order in particular. What are these abstractions that let you work with these data and these data sets, and how can you reason about them? That's a problem that will not go away through any amount of abstraction. And so that's purely about teaching and showing you how you can think differently.
Good stuff there. So yeah, you said, and I think one of the things that made Rails as successful as it was, you know, that it was this very high abstraction layer that you could think of in terms of the actual primitives that were on your mind when you're building a web app and all of the plumbing. And, you know, it was fun to beat up on like Spring MVC at the time, where you had all this XML you had to write, and oh, it was so bad, you know, and all that is, of course, cleaned up its act significantly since then. But that was the foil, and there's all the stuff you didn't have to do because of this high level of abstraction. Yet, it knew that the abstractions were going to be leaky and exposed systematic and thoughtful places where the abstractions would leak. And so it seems like whatever we do to go forward, we clearly need higher levels of abstraction. But I appreciate that you're acknowledging those are never impermeable barriers. Grady Booch said this once in a talk I heard him give. It was that the history of software engineering is one of an increasing layers of abstraction, one on top of the other, that allow us to do more with the same amount of cognitive input. But those layers always leak. And so we have to think about how they're going to leak. Just build those into, at the API level, even. They're things that we need to be able to access.
That's right. It takes a sort of pragmatism to be able to do this well, to acknowledge that you're not going to build something that's totally airtight, and then to establish the right hooks for someone who wants to go further and kind of knows what they're doing, to be able to descend and change things as are reasonable.
Yeah, as is reasonable. And that's advice I give to everybody, no matter what you're doing. You're programming at some layer of things, and you should always know at least one layer down.
That's great advice.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's gonna pop its head up occasionally.
And probably one layer up too.
And probably, yeah, exactly. one layer in either direction. So what do you think the abstractions, or maybe that's the wrong word, what are the primitives involved in stream processing? You know, when I am a developer writing stream processing code, I feel like I have a different set of primitives that I'm working from than, batch or just non-evented code. What could you reflect on that? Like, what do you think the primitives are that we need to teach people? Cause you said something about needing to teach people. What are those things?
I think Confluent nailed this far before I ever showed up. And the two primitives that we teach about are streams and tables, which streams are immutable fact sets that will sort of never go away. Every individual fact is important and is sort of recorded for all time. And tables, which are aggregations of those streams. We sort of take the stream and then we read it fact by fact. And then we maintain literally a table of everything that has changed over time, and we're able to tell you as of now what is the current state of everything from the stream. So those are like the absolute highest level primitives you can think about. And there's a great paper by some of our coworkers on how you can think about streams and tables that goes way into depth. But I think once you peel it back a layer, I guess I never really thought about this in depth, but you sort of have transformations, which is take a stream and produce a stream, which is change every fact along the way. You can sort of create queries, which are continuously running queries where you're producing these tables over time, and you're taking the information and you're changing it, and you're actually updating what you know in place to match what is the current state of things. And there are a few others like windowing, which is usually only comes up in in stream processing, where you want to actually look at maybe the last 30 minutes, or you want to look at recurring intervals of 30 minutes into the past or into the future. Sessions are another one that is sort of more stream oriented, where you're trying to detect intervals of activity for a particular entity. So these are things that you only seem to encounter in stream processing, but they end up being quite critical primitives for you to reason about how to process a stream of data in real time.
Yeah, and some of them are tricky. I mean, stream doesn't seem to be an abstraction that anybody has a lot of trouble with. When I'm describing what a stream is, the facial expressions and the eyes and everything that people in the room indicate that everybody gets it. It's not super hard. Table, though, once you've got stream in hand and everybody's persuaded that, oh, yep, everything's a stream and I got to put all my events in a stream and do computation over that stream. And then you say, well, also there are tables. That is the first time people encounter that idea. That's difficult. And it's easy to forget that when it's a world that you're immersed in, like you and I are. But I see it happen. People are like, could you go back and tell me about tables again? I didn't quite get that.
So, yeah, I think that's so reminiscent about why state is hard in programming, no matter what you're doing. As soon as you involve state, everything's become significantly harder. And it's a necessary construct in the world. I mean, you can try to use different constructs like category theory to isolate it. I personally don't feel like that helps a ton. But state is hard no matter what way you spin it. And it's hard in stream processing too.
Very true. And you know, on streaming audio, we don't do... Some podcasts will do the cold open quote, just some quote from somewhere in the interview or in the conversation. They'll open the broadcast with that. If we did that, ladies and gentlemen in the audience, once you involve state, things get dramatically harder. Would be exactly the words that this podcast would open with. So let that extended lantern hanging there on those words. Let that make those words memorable. It's very true. Once you involve state, everything's a lot harder. It's great to be stateless.
It's true.
Yeah, that's how I am with respect to my calendar, right? I can't remember anything except what's about to happen next. And, you know, if there's not a link to the document that I'm supposed to read in the invite, I just don't know. So it's really a great way to live. So tables are state, and state is harder to think about. Even as the funny thing is, even as an abstraction, it's just harder to think about state. But we get past that. And continuous queries is another one that I know it seems odd when this is the world that you live in, but people have to get that into their head a little bit. Have you seen that happen yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a complete inversion of the way that you'd use a relational database that you may be introduced to in high school or college or whatever point you pick up this kind of technology, where if you issue a query to a database, it's a transient thing. It computes the result immediately and returns you the view as of now. It sort of looks at all the data and runs whatever you asked it to and returns you an answer right now. But with continuous queries, that it's completely turned on its head. It's a persistent thing that you give the query to whatever's processing all the data as it comes by, and it's maintaining a view over time about what the current state of that, or rather what the answer is to that query is as of right now. And what you then have the power to do is to ask the query, or the view that query is generating, is figure out what the answer is right now. And you can ask it multiple times. You can ask it repeatedly, and the answer will change as more data comes through. But the magic is that, while this model seems really weird, is that the total power to the, you know, total cost to answer that query anytime you want to know it is basically free, because all the work has been done. All you need to do is maybe dereference the query and ask it, what's your current state as of now? And it just tells you what it has at that very moment. And so for queries that will be fixed over time, this is a super powerful way of building systems, because it makes your query cost almost nothing.
Ah, right. No, it is. And that's a great explanation of just the whole notion of a continuous query, by the way. And it's an important thing. You also talked about windowing. Windowing is pretty specific, right? You know, you have to be doing an aggregation or something funky like a stream join in order to even bring that into your world. But it's also not a thing that happens in batch programming, really, right?
Yeah, I think you could probably apply it to that if you squint really hard. But the idea behind windowing is that you want to take your data sets And you want to group them by time of which they occurred. And because you really can't bound, you really can't just pile up data in memory as it streams in infinitely, because you'll just run out of memory. Windows are a really nice way to reason about buckets of time, where you can sort of declare that all the data for a particular window has effectively come in and decide that you have a final result. Because there is this practical element to stream processing where you don't know if you ever got all the data, but eventually you need to make a decision because something in the real world is forcing you to decide. And so they sort of let you create these buckets where you can, on an individual basis, decide whether you have all the data or not. And so it's very useful in that respect.
Right. They also help with things like when you mentioned the problem of the cell phone going into the jungle, or I think of going onto an airplane with bad Wi-Fi. Sometimes you can get data that arrives later than it ought to have. You can get out of order data.
That's right.
And Windows also help you reason about that. If you've got data that comes late, it has a place to go and it has a result to affect. You kind of know what bin that goes into if you're averaging, or there's some other reducing function you're running over the set of data in the window. You know where to put that new event and which window result to go recompute when you get late data. And late data will always happen.
Exactly. And I think that again, speaks to like another element of streaming that is inextricably linked together, which is time. And if I could have a second quote, anytime you bring time into the equation, things get a lot harder. Which is probably another way to say you're dealing with state in some sense, but that's a little bit more of a fuzzy concept. But it's precisely that the possibility for unordered data makes things much more complicated.
Absolutely, yep. And there's a bunch of, even in terms of implementation in your state processor, now there's a bunch of memory that you might need, and all kinds of pain that goes into that. That library that does that stream processing.
Exactly.
Which is a segue to your work. You built a closure-based stream processing library, and there are a couple of things there that are worth talking about. Number one, you made a choice of closure because you liked it and it was a community you're involved in. You don't need to reflect on that, but why a library? And an answer you can't give is because that's what closure programmers do with everything, is they make a library. I'm taking that answer off the table, but
that's fine.
A lot of people think, if I'm doing stream processing, I have infrastructure I need to stand up, right? Like if you took kind of legacy Hadoop architectural assumptions where I'm doing distributed computing of batch data, and now I want to do distributed computing of streaming data. And so I'm not building a library, I'm building infrastructure. You didn't do that. You built a library. So, and maybe it was just the sensibilities of the closure community and that it seemed obvious to do it that way. But do you have any other reasons why you did that?
I actually do. So I was a user of Storm and I was a user of Hadoop at the time. And I noticed that when you write these programs for either batch or real-time systems, it's different. You write this program and you create a jar, and then you invoke this like Hadoop submit job or whatever it was called.
It serializes your bytecode and...
Yeah, it's very strange. It takes your program and then it zips it up and it sends it over the wire, and then it puts it onto these workers that run over there. I don't exactly know where it is. They're on some machines, but it's a very different programming model. And actually, in a lot of frameworks, it sort of creates this different inversion in the way that you program altogether, or the abstractions, they're kind of strung together in such a way that it supports this code distribution. And that always struck me as being really weird and maybe unnecessary. And so I thought, wouldn't it be kind of interesting if you just sort of took your program and then put it there yourself? Like, surely there's some good tools to do that. And in 2013 or 2014 or so, there was like Ansible, and there was a couple other good orchestration tools. And I thought that was good enough. And this was before Kubernetes really started to become a thing.
Right.
And later in time, as I built more and more of this out, it seemed more apparent that this was the right choice, because you got your programming model back. You could just program in a completely normal way and package it up as a library. And then also you can use some of these great tools to do distribution. There's a number of things that I put into Onyx that I would completely rip out today, like scheduling or tags and placement. because Kubernetes and its related tools offload all of these things. And so I think that this is the direction, and obviously the one that CoffeeStream's picked, which I think is great. It's just a library. It's just an application. You embed it in your process, and you let all these other tools do some hard problems that they're really good at doing in a dedicated way.
Very well put. And I guess when Storm was emerging in like 2012, Ansible was new, if it even existed. Certainly Chef and Puppet were kind of the big guys in the room for deployment automation. But that was new. That was super high tech.
Yeah.
The idea of, I write this file and it's code, it's executable code, and it goes and makes my infrastructure happen because of these agents and this thing. And, you know, that was a brand new idea. The 10 or 15 years prior to that, so the generation that's building Hadoop and building Storm kind of spent a long time where there was really stasis in the way in deployment automation technologies. And I say automation very charitably. there was not a lot of innovation in the way code got deployed. And there were lots of, Java container kind of systems that, you know, there was never a really good story there. And so those systems grow up with the assumption that their infrastructure, and they're telling you, you're going to deploy your code this way. You know, you describe this process of zipping up your code and sending it over there, which I think, in fairness, it was a bad idea, and I'm glad we're past it. But in fairness to them, it was conceivable because there was no Kubernetes and there was no Docker, and deployment automation wasn't a thing that you felt guilty because you didn't do. You know,
absolutely.
In 2010, you felt guilty because you didn't write automated tests. You didn't have a test suite. Deployment automation, you didn't even know that you should feel guilty for that yet. And, these days, that's, I think, the probably leading cause of developer shame is not tests anymore, but, my deployment pipeline is bad.
Yeah, I totally agree. Really, whatever it took to get to where we're at was kind of a good thing. And maybe we're on the path of like GDD, guilt-driven development, and that's how we'll proceed into the future.
We always are. I don't think it's ever going to change, but it's more like guilt-driven, what do I learn next?
Yeah.
Shame-driven, this part of my stack is bad. But since those things are here, now this library-based approach made sense to you, and I love your answer, by the way. Why did you make it a library? Well, I used Storm and Hadoop, so... it seemed like that was not the right thing to continue doing. And that, of course, has been the choice of Kafka Streams to be a library.
That's right.
And it is, you mentioned earlier, it is a Java-based library, so it tends to find efficient use in languages of the JVM. I would say particularly languages that are relatively more proximate to Java. So, Scala, Kotlin, Groovy, probably not a giant lift to do Kafka Streams stuff from them. I have never tried any Kafka Streams from Clojure, and I've never asked anybody who has. Have you?
I have. It works great. Actually, okay. You just call through to the JVM bindings, and it works like a charm. So, which is really the strength of the JVM shining through.
Yeah, exactly. And Clojure's Java interop has always been a
that's true.
A featured feature. Which gets us to, you wrote one in Clojure that was native to Clojure. You're familiar with Kafka Streams and the library. I guess the upside of the library approach is, like you said, you get your programming model back. You get to write a computer program. And if you want to write a Spring Boot app that exposes the state store through a REST interface, you just get to kind of annotate that and it works. And, you have access to that whole tool that has nothing to do with stream processing. And the actual stream processing code you write looks and feels like software. It's not like somebody hitting you in the head, like the bad old days of I can implement a map function and a reduce function. It's code. The downside being that library is not efficient to implement twice. Like if I write Kafka Streams in Java, how far ahead of the game am I for the Python version?
Yeah, it's tough. And I think this problem actually even goes beyond, treating something as a library, because even in Storm, where you had something that was mostly written in Java and Clojure, and it was fully distributed in that way that we talked about, it still needs a channel to invoke the behavior that you're asking it to do. And so the language that you author the system in is quite tightly bound from the choice of languages that you can author your stream processing programs in as well, because they sort of need to communicate. And so this is really the big challenge, is that a lot of the smarts for how to carry out the instructions that you give it are tightly bound to the language that the tool is authored in. And this is one of the things that I really like about KSQL. KSQL lets you create these programs in a SQL dialect independent of any programming language. And so it allows you to jump out of this dynamic and essentially just create something that's at a higher level. And so you don't need to go through the cost of re-implementing the platform in Java and Python and any other language that you might want to use. But you can use it just once, and you can use SQL to do it in a declarative way.
And that is powerful. That gets you the ability to write basically one stream processing program. And, you know, if you don't have a library provided for you in language of your choice, that's not a JVM language, it's okay. You write that stream processing program in KSQL, run it on, you know, some little piece of infrastructure that's executing a KSQL query, some server, and your stream processing gets done that way. What do you
That's
see?
Right.
Here's another great PM question. Ladies and gentlemen in the listening public, a lot of these questions I have not asked Michael before. I mean, we work together, we talk several times a week, but I'm actually just getting to pick his brain as an important thought leader in the space now. So it's fun for me too. But in the future, and if you can, this is a forward-looking question, so just tell me to not ask it if you can't answer it. What do you think the distribution will be between the amount of stream processing I do in KSQL and the amount of stream processing I do in some library native to my runtime, like Kafka Streams? Will KSQL be, you know, 98% of all stream processing, and a few extremists will write Kafka Streams, or what? How do you think that's going to shake out?
I think you end up at some 80-20 sort of deal, where 80% of it is best solved by a really well-built declarative solution, and 20% is more of the imperative route. I think there's always going to be some class of problems where you really do need a low-level way of solving your problem, and you need full control over every dial and every control you have to solve your thing. But I think that there's a lot of really simple problems out there, and you know, a lot of important work is just actually kind of boring, and it's pretty easy to describe if you peel away all the layers of hype. And I think a high level declarative solution is a great answer there. You know, that said, I also think that these kinds of programs and their complexities will start to fade away in terms of the accidental complexity that they bring, and it will start to feel more and more like a single threaded normal program where possible. And so that really leads me to think that these higher level things that can be described using declarative languages like SQL will ultimately succeed, because you sort of want to get back to as much normalcy and as much reasoning power as you can. And as you go to these lower levels, you sort of take on more complexity than you might need. So I think that's kind of how it pans out.
What excites you the most looking forward about stream processing? Like, you know, that KSQL may be becoming a more it's expanding a fill more of the ecosystem would be great, but what do you think is the coolest thing that's going to happen coming up outside of any products you might be working on? Of course, that's not a thing that we discuss. It's like Fight Club.
I'm honestly not sure what's going to happen in general. I do think that the most exciting thing is how much is unsolved. So it's the whole reason I got in the game, is that this is clearly a really interesting part of software engineering, and things in business only ever become more real time, more dynamic, less expensive. And you always want to head in this direction. And we have some pieces to doing this really well today, but we clearly don't have all of them. And I think you could pick any aspect of stream processing, be either the deployment model, the infrastructure, the way you think about state, the way you observe it, pick anything. And I think there will be really interesting stones to turn over in the next 10 or 15 or 20 years. That's what excites me the most, is how far we have to go.
My guest today has been Michael Dragalis. Michael, thanks for being a part of Streaming Audio.
Thanks, Tim.
And there you have it. I hope that was helpful to you. If you've got questions, you can ask me at TLBerglund on Twitter. That's TLBERGLUND. Or you can leave a comment on any of our YouTube videos. Your question might be featured on the next episode of Streaming Audio. And feel free to subscribe to our YouTube channel and this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. And if you subscribe through iTunes, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover the podcast and just generally helps us get the word out. We appreciate your support. See you next time.